Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is John Kalambokides. John is a research biologist and one of the founders of Cascadia Research, a nonprofit research organization formed in 1979 and based in Olympia. John has directed long-term research on the status, movements, and underwater behavior of blue, humpback, and gray whales. His work has been covered on shows by the Discovery Channel and has also been featured in National Geographic TV specials. John will be giving the next lecture in the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Ocean series. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. A hint. This sound is often heard on the Quipper Peninsula, especially in winter, but its maker is not often seen. So just a few quick observations. Nora, what have people seen?
Well, participants in the Admiralty Audubon New Year's field trip to Irondale Beach Park counted 25 species of birds, including gadwall, American widgeon, mallards, surf scoters, buffleheads, common and hooded mergansers, horned and red-necked grebes, and even a marbled murrelet.
And Wendy Feltham enjoyed looking under western red cedars and other conifers in the Port Hadlock, Irondale area, and finding wonderful fungi, white fairy fingers, vermilion wax cap, and the white coral fungus. And now on to my conversation with John Kalambokides. Well, many of us are familiar with the story of the dwindling orca populations in the Salish Sea. But what about the larger whales? My guest today, John Kalambokides of Cascadia Research, has been researching the long-term population trends, movements, and underwater behavior of blue, humpback, and gray whales in the Salish Sea and in the North Pacific. John is especially interested in the interactions of humans and marine mammals. So welcome, John.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, tell me, I am not familiar with Cascadia Research. What is your organization and what kinds of research do you do?
Yes, well, it's an organization I helped found in 1979, and our goal was to do real scientific research, but that addressed important issues related to the protection and conservation of marine mammals. And so we've tried to target things like different threats that exist to marine mammals, and especially of different endangered populations,
mm-hmm.
and try to conduct that research in a way that then kind of helps promote conservation and decision-making related to them. So we're actually celebrating our 40th year.
That's impressive.
In existence. have been going a while. We subsist mostly on federal and state grants or contracts
mm-hmm.
That support research where there's an interest in getting the answers to the kind of work we do. And we have major programs along the U.S. West Coast. We're based here in Olympia, Washington. And we also have a very active program in Hawaii as well.
Oh, interesting. I'm really excited about your longevity and success and about the fact that you've been able to combine the science and the decision-making to hopefully have us as a population make better decisions based on better information.
Right.
So, just for background, how about sharing a bit about the various marine mammal species that visit the Salish Sea and the outer coast of Washington? Well, give us the species list. Who comes here?
Sure. And what's been interesting, and I think part of the excitement of some of the recent research is that, you know, my work takes me up and down the West Coast, and I do a lot of work in California, but generally through much of our existence, the story of large whales inside the Salish Sea and especially into Puget Sound was fairly limited. And what's been exciting is in the last decade, we've seen some pretty dramatic changes in the currents of especially some of the large whale species that use our waters. So it's become much more interesting locally in recent years than it had been through much of my early research on some of these species. And I'm excited to be doing more work in my backyard.
Yeah, let me go out on whale wash tours. And I'm seeing more humpbacks and more grays. And I didn't know whether they had been here all the time and I just wasn't seeing them. Or are those two of the species you're talking about increasing in abundance?
Absolutely. No, gray whales and humpback whales are both species that we've both learned more about and through that process have discovered they are using our waters to a degree much greater than either they had before or that we were aware of before. And probably most dramatically have been humpback whales. And a lot of my studies starting in the mid-1980s focused on humpback whales, especially off California, but all along the U.S. West Coast and up here off Washington. We primarily only had humpback whales off the Washington coast from the entrance of the Strait of Juan de Fuca to more offshore waters, areas called the Prairie or Swiftsure Bank, west of the northern Washington coast and quite a ways offshore. And that's what really began to change about 10 years ago. We've seen the overall population recovering from whaling, and I think as it's recovered, we've seen this expansion into some former habitats that they were not using prior to that.
So why do you think that is?
Well, you know, we think of whaling as something that occurred a long time ago or is only practiced by other countries like Japan or Iceland or Norway. But really, whaling off the U.S. West Coast and in U.S. waters occurred for humpback whales through 1966.
Really?
And that's actually not that long ago. We had whaling stations operating out of San Francisco Bay that were taking humpback whales off the California coast in areas that we study them currently.
I had no idea it was that recent.
Yeah, and that's, well, these are long-lived species, you know, slow reproducing. So really what we're seeing is the continued recovery of some of these species from the whaling pressure. It's a little more complicated with gray whales, but I'll get into that. But for humpback whales, we had documented about a 7 to 8% annual increase that's been occurring over the last 30 years. And mostly that was visible as increased numbers in these offshore areas. We studied them, but what we noticed starting about 10 years ago is as those numbers recovered, they also returned to some of these former habitats. And the story inside the Salish Sea is interesting. There was actually whaling that occurred all along the coast of British Columbia and Washington in the early and mid-1900s. But most dramatically, in the early 1900s, there were whalers that discovered there were humpback whales that were sometimes even overwintering inside the Salish Sea and Puget Sound. And it was much too rough to hunt off the coast in open ocean waters. So for a number of years, they actually targeted and specifically hunted the whales that used the Salish Sea, killing, you know, several hundred of them. And I think at that point, largely wiping out what had been a more resident group of humpback whales that only now is getting recolonized.
So that's what leads you to say that they are reestablishing that territory that they once occupied.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, unfortunately, the level of data and information we have of what that looked like pre-whaling is often kind of sketchy. So we don't have great precision to know how much more would it grow, what was really normal. But in the very early 1900s, there was enough humpback whales occurring around the south end of Vancouver Island that there was actually whale watch operators that took people out in the early 1900s to see humpback whales going out of, you know, South Vancouver Island and areas like that, that then, you know, largely got eliminated once those humpbacks got eliminated. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing not just the return of the whales, but that large whale watch operation mm-hmm. that grew up and developed around seeing resident killer whales now is increasingly also taking people out to see humpback whales as well as great whales. And we're seeing kind of a return of that interest. Many people don't realize that there was even whale watching going on in the early 1900s
prior
to them being wiped out.
Yeah. So just kind of a guesstimate, how badly was the humpback whale population affected by the commercial whaling?
Yes, well, on North Pacific wide, and I've participated in a couple of studies to try to estimate the humpback whale population across the whole North Pacific. The estimates in the 1960s were that it may have been down to about 2,000 to 3,000 humpback whales in the whole North Pacific.
Wow.
Another early number that I would state would be when we started our research off California in the mid-1980s, our initial estimates were under 500 humpback whales using the California waters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that compares to our estimates now for the whole North Pacific are more like 20,000 to 30,000
Wow.
humpback whales, and our estimates for the whole U.S. West Coast have also grown and now are in closer to the 3,000-4,000 neighborhood. Those are roughly, you're talking almost tenfold increases from what we thought might be the low point in the 1960s or so.
So is there the sense that the population is still growing, or has it reached its sustainable balanced level? Or
yeah, they're what we'd call their carrying capacity.
Right.
And, you know, if I had been asked that question two or three years ago, I would have said there were some strong indicators that it had reached carrying capacity. And that's why it was expanding into areas, and there were even some regions further north of Washington where we were even seeing declining numbers of humpback whales. Now I'm not quite so sure, especially with some of these shifts in areas that animals are using. We are actually just about 1 to 2 months away from some new estimates that stem from a much more extensive set of surveys that we did in 2018 and 19 that I'm kind of looking to tell me, you know, whether there's been a continued uptick since that period when I thought it had leveled off. So it's unclear whether it has leveled off or maybe now has become more variable with good and bad years and maybe, you know, slight increases for a few years and then downturns. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, especially I keep alluding to things that we're actually thinking that we're seeing happening with gray whales, where we think that population, at least the eastern North Pacific gray whale population, had fully recovered to carrying capacity. And that might be part of what's played a role in some of these unusual high mortality years like we had in 2019. Mm-hmm. We had record numbers of gray whales wash up dead
right.
in Washington State. And up and down the West Coast, we also saw elevated levels that rivaled a previous mortality event we had in 1999-2000. And that might be more of what becomes normal once populations reach carrying capacity. It may not be that they are stable and everything's normal, but we see more of these fluctuations, you know, based on, you know, ocean conditions, prey abundance, and other factors. And that ties to, of course, one of our biggest areas of concern, you know, vulnerability of these species to, you know, climate change mm-hmm. and things that might change the availability of their prey.
Quick question. I should know the answer to this, but I'm just kind of curious. Are the humpbacks breeding in our area, or did they breed somewhere else?
Yes, you know, most of the large baleen whales go through these annual migrations.
Right, like the grays. We're pretty familiar
with
that.
Like the gray
yeah.
whales. Gray whales probably represent the most regimented of those migrations, and humpback whales close behind them, where they largely fast and don't feed in winter months and typically travel to low latitude breeding wintering areas, which is where they mate, give birth to their calves, mm-hmm. and nurse their calves. And part of that is a function of both gray whales and humpback whales are filter feeders.
Yeah.
They feed by filtering their prey. It can be an incredibly efficient way to feed when prey density is high, but it can also be a very inefficient way to feed when prey density is low, where it might not even be worth, you know, when you feed on tiny creatures like humpback whales, it's mm-hmm. either small schooling fish or krill, mm-hmm. you really rely on there being a high
a
density
lot.
Of them
yeah.
for each gulp to be worthwhile. And I think it's partly that feeding mechanism that has made them undertake these migrations where it's just not worth the effort for many individuals in winter, and it's better off for them to go to warmer waters mm-hmm. where they can give birth to calves with, you know, a smaller blubber layer where they can somewhat escape the higher densities of transient mammal-eating killer whales mm-hmm. that often prey and attack the calves. Mm-hmm. And all of that make that kind of a better strategy for them. So our humpback whales here in Washington actually most commonly go to Mexico and Hawaii as those winter breeding areas they go to, with some of the animals sometimes going to some of the other known winter areas mm-hmm. like off Central America, and in rare occasion all the way over to waters south of Japan.
Actually, I was just sort of struck by how many grays washed ashore. Were there other factors involved?
Yes, though some of them still being very much investigated. Gray whales in this eastern North Pacific had recovered, and some of the abundance estimates that were made of this eastern North Pacific gray whale population suggested they were around 27,000 of them, which, you know, actually was even a little bit higher than some of the estimates of what had existed pre-whaling. So we had some good indications that they were probably at or very near or maybe even slightly above what had been that historical carrying capacity for them, and that they had reached that actually a number of years ago. As a scientist, I sort of thought as a long-lived, slow-reproducing animals, when, you know, when these animals reach that carrying capacity, you'd see the normal, you know, decline in birth rates and a slight increase in mortality rates, and then they'd be more stable. And instead, what might be emerging, at least in the case of gray whales, is that, you know, we were actually seeing some very big boom years, you know, even a few years ago, and then we had this huge mortality event last year. We had 34 gray whales wash up dead in Washington State alone last year, the highest we had ever seen in any year. And so maybe what might be emerging is that when these populations more reach carrying capacity, it makes them much more susceptible to variations in that food supply. When they were well below that limit, they could absorb some of that fluctuation. But now that they're near carrying capacity, these up and down variations in their prey supply, they're much more vulnerable. Carrying capacity is one aspect of this. But there's another factor at work, which is why was there a downturn?
Yeah, and I also want to put humans in the picture here, too.
Absolutely. We know the main feeding area for these gray whales is up in the Arctic, and we know the Arctic ecosystems have undergone huge changes. Some of the most dramatic changes due to climate change have been documented in Arctic waters with changes in ice cover. And there are elements of that that may actually have benefited gray whales. Gray whales were very dependent on ice cover and having areas they could access, you know, where they could still surface and breathe. So some aspects of climate change may have benefited them in expanded habitat that they could feed in. But much more critical would be the density of prey and how productive those benthic areas, the areas on the bottom that gray whales principally feed, are. And those are the kind of questions we still don't know the answer to. But it's clear that this isn't just they've reached carrying capacity. You wouldn't expect this much of an uptick in mortality, but it certainly is one factor at work here.
So actually, talk to me just a little bit. I'm curious about other effects of human-related causes. How are they responding to noise as well as other things? How are they responding to the human world they live in?
Yes, and we do know there are three pretty important factors, and you've touched on one of them that we know are having an effect on these populations, both humpback whales in particular, but gray whales to a similar degree. One has been the increasing amount of noise and ship traffic has resulted in two types of impacts that we've been concerned with. One is the insonification of the oceans and the increasing amount of noise. That's one that has been a little bit harder to quantify, but a very closely related one to that has been an increase in vessel strikes of whales. Up and down the West Coast, we have seen, you know, in the last 15, 20 years, increased evidence that ship strikes and vessel strikes are having a pretty large number of mortalities on whales. You know, and some species like blue whales and fin whales, which we also have off Washington, though less commonly inside the Salish Sea, seem to be the most susceptible species. But humpbacks are also up there as a species that we've been documenting increased numbers of these ship strikes. And then the third item is entanglement, particularly in gillnet fisheries and the Dungeness crab fishery, just partly because there are hundreds of thousands of Dungeness crab pots that are deployed along the U.S. West Coast, primarily in winter and spring, but also to a more limited degree extending into the summer. We've seen record numbers of entanglement mortalities, you know, as well. 2018 was a big increased year of documented entanglements of humpbacks and gray whales. And up and down the West Coast, we've seen this with humpback whales, you know, in areas like California, where we're getting dozens of these documented entanglements. And one of the things that concerns us, both with ship strikes and entanglements, is that we know the documented mortality represents a small fraction of what is actually occurring. Most of these whales inhabit difficult to access areas, and if they're killed, they'll sink or disappear or not wash up, and we won't document it. So if we document, like we did in 2018, 18 entanglement-related mortalities in Washington State, we know the true number could be 10 times that high. On the one hand, the increasing population is part of the cause of that in two ways. There are more whales, but there are whales using more areas that overlap with humans. So we also need to keep that in perspective of that increasing population.
It's easy to get pretty gloomy about the fate of various species on our Earth. What gives you hope in doing this kind of work?
There are two things about whales. First of all, there are some major success stories. Our cessation of whaling off the U.S. West Coast has resulted in recoveries of these populations. It really is a demonstration. We can make a difference, and things are much better for some large whale species due to the changes we made in whaling. Number two is, I do view, as someone who studies whales, and all of us can relate to whales as this iconic species of the marine environment. You know, I feel a responsibility. That's a really powerful way for people to relate to why we need to protect our oceans, because ultimately whales are dependent on the entire ocean ecosystem. And so, you know, they're the ones we can easily relate to, but we need to remember that they're dependent on other species and the proper operation of that ecosystem. That makes it, I think, exciting and valuable to study those species, just because they do capture people's imaginations and we can relate to them in these ways that are harder to relate to others, less iconic species.
Well, thank you so much, John. This has been just, it's just tickled my curiosity now to know oh so much more.
Oh, great. Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Well, let's hear this week's mystery sound again. Those were the haunting, eerie, ethereal-sounding whistles of the colorful, varied thrush, resident of the dense rainforests of the Pacific Northwest. The first sound clip was a male varied thrush singing on its breeding grounds. The song is a whistled, flute-like tone on a single pitch. Each song lasts for about 2 seconds, and followed by a pause of 3 to 20 seconds, and then successive tones may be on different pitches. The second recording were calls that both males and females make in aggression or in defense. Varied thrushes are stocky songbirds. The males have a dark blue-gray on the back and a rich burnt orange breast with a sooty black breastband and an orange line over the eye. Females are similar but just slightly more muted. A winter wanderer, the varied thrush breeds in the moist, dense coniferous forests and mixed forests, and then moves to lower elevations in the winter, where they may be found in backyards, orchards, thickets, and even at my bird feeder this winter. So a few upcoming events. You're going to be giving a talk up here on Sunday. It's entitled Recent Changes in Large Whale Occurrence and Threats in Washington.
And that title sounds a little dry. I will let you know some of the new breakthroughs in how we're doing research, like deployment of suction cup attached tags that include video, have also kind of created these very exciting ways to relate to and see how these whales live. So I think the talk will have both a hopeful message, it'll bring up some of these threats, but there'll also be some pretty exciting footage that I'm going to be able to show. Some of it has not been seen before, what these whales' lives are like underwater from the whales' perspective.
Cool. And join the Natural History Society of the Jefferson Land Trust on Tuesday, January the 14th, for an exploration of old-growth stumps and what they mean to forest health. The walk is at the Port Gamble Forest Heritage Park on old logging roads and modestly maintained trails with little elevation gain. This is one of the largest lowland forests remaining in West Puget Sound. Check the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society webpage for details.
Want to use your birding skills to advance our understanding of climate change's impact on birds? Then the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society's Climate Watch is for you. Learn how birds are responding to climate change, be a citizen scientist, and survey target species in your area. Check the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society's webpage for details for this month-long project that begins on Wednesday, January 15th.
So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer editor was Nora Petrich. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. The ending music is Songs of the Humpback Whale. It was a 1970s album produced by scientist Roger Payne, and it publicly demonstrated for the very first time the elaborate whale vocalization of humpbacks. It became the best-selling environmental album in history. It raises the awareness of the intelligence and the culture of the whales and helped spawn a worldwide Save the Whales movement. Thanks for listening.